Buffalo can hang on. This is going to be a good one.
The fans at Kansas Speedway know how to have a good time. And you are all invited. NASCAR weekend at Kansas Speedway, May 4th and 5th. Get your tickets now at kansasspeedway.com.
Second half of the program begins right now around the country, 2 minutes at a time, talking to the people covering the stories where they're happening. We call it the two-minute drill, and one of the places the story was happening was I was actually in Miami as Notre Dame. Went on the road, Catholics versus convicts. The rivalry was renewed over the weekend, and to the chagrin of the Notre Dame Fighting Irish as they were flying high in the Championship Bowl standings, and then just knocked down 41-8, Miami wins. Let's go to South Bend to start things off. That's where Sean Stiers is, WSBT Radio in South Bend. Sean, how are you?
Doing good. How about you?
Not bad. What happened? What went wrong? Was it a bad day for the Irish, or is Miami that much better than Notre Dame?
You know, a lot went wrong for the Irish, and I mean, at least for that night, Miami was that much better. I mean, just a couple of weeks ago, Notre Dame plastered USC, and I don't know that they're that much better than USC, but at least for that night, they were. And I mean, the run game just never got going, and when you're averaging over 300 yards a game and you're in the top five of the nation, you got to get that going, and they just never could, and for a lot of different reasons. I mean, you asked how good Miami is. When Notre Dame lost to Georgia by 1 point in week two, we were all kind of pointing at this Miami defense saying this is going to be the next really fast, really good defense they're going to see. Now, USC and NC State both had pretty good run defenses, and Notre Dame managed to plow through both of them in consecutive weeks. And at the same time, Miami was really struggling with teams like Georgia Tech, Syracuse, North Carolina, and a North Carolina team that Notre Dame just waxed a few weeks ago. So we kind of were feeling like, well, maybe this Miami team isn't as good as we thought, but the Irish just could never get the run game on track. And a big part of that is Josh Adams, their leading rusher. One of the things he does so well is he's really patient. He waits for blocks. But Miami just didn't want to let him be patient and wait for blocks. They were so fast off the line. The Irish offensive line, as good as it is, just could never get anything set, anything developed for him.
Yeah, and they don't have the quarterback play, right? Let's be honest. They didn't change quarterbacks mid-game because they've, you know, got a star in the making sitting anywhere. They've got to run the ball and play defense. Miami ran up and down the field on them, 237 on the ground against that Irish defense, and an Irish defense that had to play a lot more than they're used to because their own ground game wasn't going, wasn't burning the clock. You know, hell of a season, great bounce back year for Brian Kelly, but you're not going to win a national championship unless you're better at quarterback, right?
Yeah, and I mean, the weird thing about Brandon Wimbush is right now he's known as a running quarterback, and coming out of high school out of New Jersey, he was not known as a running quarterback. He was recruited for his ability to throw the ball, and both in the spring and in early in August in training camp and the practice windows that we got to see, I mean, he was an accurate, strong-arm quarterback who was making all the throws. For whatever reason, you know, games are much faster than practice, but he has just not been on with his arm. He's just been all over the place with it. Part of their running game is Brandon Wimbush, and he's had 400-yard rushing games this year. He's their second-leading rusher. And even when the game was still close, they never really tried to utilize him with his running ability to kind of get his skill set going. And so between the fact that he was erratic and all over the place throwing the ball, had some drops too from some of his receivers, but they just never utilized him early on when they still had a chance to try to open some other things up. And on the other side, Miami was able to do that with their quarterback, Rozier.
All right, Navy, a team that's a good, solid Navy team and is going to treat this like their Super Bowl. Maybe that's not fair with Army there at the end. But they get up for this game in a big way, and they're kind of a tricky team to defend. And then turn around and go to Palo Alto against Stanford. I mean, so and Stanford just beat Washington, and they're a solid team, only three losses on the year. How does this season end? What does it look like when it's all said and done for the Irish?
Well, I think at the very worst, they're probably going to be 9-3. Navy as you said, I mean, they're not an easy team to defend, and Notre Dame does have some issues with their own defense right now, trying to get some things figured out. Navy's been pretty up and down, though, kind of keeping track of their season, and they've turned the ball over pretty uncharacteristically. They've had some problems on both sides of the ball. They've got a new defensive coordinator this year. So I think with just Notre Dame's mass up front, that speed that Miami had, obviously, that's not something Navy can replicate. So they should be okay this week. But the Stanford game, probably a toss-up. It is out there in Palo Alto, and you do have to deal with the nation's leading rusher in Bryce Love. So a toss-up. I think, you know, if they're 9-3, it's still a marked improvement over 4-8 last year. They'd like to be 10-2, obviously, and get into one of those New Year's Six bowls.
All right, and the Irish real quick. We're already talking about the Irish. The basketball team, I should say, real quick. Bonzi Colson, an All-American. They win over DePaul by 14 points. They've got another tune-up game tonight. I don't even know. Who is MSM? I don't even know what the hell that is.
Mount St. Mary's.
Mount St. Mary's. Okay, so, you know, not St. Mary's, Mount St. Mary's. To be clear,
right.
St. Mary's has been a good program out in the West Coast Conference. And then they head out to Maui and will, if they advance, and it's set up for them to advance, I think they're the one seed because they open with Chaminade. They'll
right.
get Wichita all the way in the finals in a field that's not as strong as maybe this tournament has been. But how good are these 14th-ranked Notre Dame Fighting Irish when it comes to the basketball season?
Well, the DePaul game on Saturday, it was actually pretty close for most of the first half. They kind of pulled away. We thought that maybe they'd look a little bit better. Now, they did look better Saturday against DePaul than they did in their exhibitions. The big question for them is, are they going to be able to play defense? They were really good defensively last year, but they lost their best defender in Steve Astoria, and they also lost their best outside threat in V.J. Beachum. So that's they did get some three-pointers. They got five from Matt Farrell the other day, the point guard, and five as well from T.J. Gibbs, a kid who lost 17 pounds from last year and is already looking a lot more athletic. So they should be okay. They're kind of trying to figure out some of these roles, which is what Mike Bray is known for in these early portions of the season in November and December.
18 points, 13 rebounds, 5 assists from Colson. That's pretty
not
good
a bad day
start.
For Bonnie.
Yeah, yeah, he's pretty good. It's nice to have that guy on your team while you're trying to figure out that lineup. Sean Stiers in South Bend. Great stuff, buddy. We appreciate it. Have a great week.
All right. Take care. Thanks.
Ian Furness, KJR, is in Seattle, Washington. Ian, how are you?
Good, Seren. How are you?
Not bad. Washington, what? This is the final nail in the coffin of the Pac-12. The league cannibalizes itself. Stanford getting the win at home against the Huskies. And that ends any thought that a Pac-12 team is going to get in the playoffs, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, really, Washington was their best hope. I mean, I guess USC remains a little bit of a long shot, depending on if, you know, we see a little bit more carnage take place in the rest of the polls and in the top 10. But I think effectively Washington losing to Stanford at Stanford on Friday night at a game that most of the country missed the first quarter with because the fine television contract the Pac-12 has. We watched truck races out here in Seattle for the first quarter, but it's just not meant to be. I mean, this is a conference that, you know, you can make an argument, Seren, that there is a lot of parity. And, you know, 1 through 11, with Oregon State being an exception, someone can knock off someone every week. We've kind of seen that this year. You can make the argument that maybe it's just an average conference with a bunch of average teams, no great teams. It just kind of pick your poison. But long story short, they're done as far as the college football playoff is concerned.
Yeah, but I can work you up the scenario where they do actually get there. TCU loses another game, perhaps in the Big 12 rematch against OU. Oklahoma State, you know, doesn't get into the championship game. Notre Dame loses at Stanford. Ohio State loses to Michigan. Georgia falls to Alabama in the SEC championship game. Auburn falls to Alabama in the Iron Bowl. Wisconsin loses to Michigan then again, perhaps to Ohio State in a championship game. And Clemson loses in the ACC championship game to Miami. That opens up that fourth spot for you. That's all you need, and USC's there. You like that?
I like that. I think the only thing for USC then, they better really hope that when it's all said and done that it's probably Washington State that gets there to the Pac-12 championship game. And for the simple fact that they would be the highest-ranked team, they would probably be in the round, the I'm guessing around 12 to 10 range at that point in time. If they, because if they get there, they have a bye this week. They'd beat Washington this coming weekend. You'd want Washington to beat Utah and remain in the top 15. Then Washington State, which would be higher ranked, win the Apple Cup. And then maybe USC beats them in the Pac-12 championship game. If Stanford gets there with their three losses and maybe four losses once Notre Dame whacks them, I think the chances are about zero when it's all said and done.
It's been 4 days since the Seahawks played, but certainly an eventful game for them on that Thursday night football game. Let's start with Russell Wilson. Basically, they pull the tent down, which is its own little shenanigans right there. Pull it down, he quickly throws it back up and goes out on the game. And listen, I get it. Everyone talks about, well, he had a concussion and they didn't. I'm fine with the conclusion that he didn't have a concussion, but there is a protocol that every team's supposed to follow. They didn't. And what, are they? They're going to be fined, and that's it? That's all that comes of this?
Yeah, I think that's what's going to happen. They're going to get fined. Paul Allen, one of the richest men in the world, won't care. They'll write a check and move on. And, you know, I'm with you. I'm fine with putting him back in if they determine that he's okay. And, you know, a concussion, I mean, it's such a hot topic right now. I mean, it's such a big-time issue around football and sports in general. I mean, not just football, obviously hockey and some of the contact sports, but you know, at the end of the day, the referee was the one that sent him to the sideline. It wasn't from up above in the booth. The official who saw him get popped in the jaw area, he sent him to the sideline. The medical staff looked at him. You know, they determined right off the get-go that he was fine. You know, and watching him after the game, there seemed to be no ill effects. And you know, he said he was fine. And I think that, you know, I know this. Soren, you know, you're around sports for a long time, so have I. I know a lot of guys, you know, and I travel with the Seahawks every week. I know a lot of guys on the medical staff and who and what they're about. And I just think that the thought that they would just carelessly and recklessly throw a guy that is a franchise player back in there without being certain, or if there is a hint that he had a concussion, I think it's ludicrous. Now, you're right. There's a protocol. They're supposed to follow it. They'll pay the price. They'll move on. But I think that sometimes there's insinuations that these guys that are medical professionals are recklessly just kind of tossing guys back around and into games, and I don't think that's always the case. I think that's actually unfair to them.
Is the, you know, the equipment guy to blame for not having his helmet hidden? Is the doctor for the Seahawks to blame, or is it just the protocol sucks? A work in progress, maybe that's unfair to say sucks, work in progress that you've got to get the guy off the field, and when he runs back out there that quick, somebody on the sidelines has got to be monitoring it and has got to put a stop to the game and say, no, he's got to get back off the field till he really goes through the protocol. I mean, because it's a little bit of, you know, I don't want to say the goal is to concuss somebody to get him out of the game to at least miss plays for the protocol process, but if you're going to have it, everybody has to play by it. Is it really right, a failure by the NFL to have the proper amount of people on the sideline to keep him from getting back out on the field?
Well, and you put a third party down there in amongst a team that he's not a part of. Good luck on winning that battle, right? I mean, it's not going to happen. And I think the protocol is what a lot of things are in our world these days. And I think it's just, you know, it's there it's kind of lip service. It's kind of eye candy. It's like, let's appease everybody. See, we have a protocol in place. This will alleviate any issues in the future. Stop it. You know what? Here's the thing. If the guy's concussed, there's a team of doctors and trainers that have gone through more concussion protocol training than any clown sitting in a boardroom in New York has ever thought of doing. Those guys know what they're looking for and looking at, and if they determine he got popped in the jaw, you know, and we know that guys can get concussions for that. We all understand that. But he got popped in the jaw. He's trying to put his jaw back in place. It was a late hit. Referee, untrained, on the field says, hey, take a look at him. They take a look at him. He's fine. They send him back in. I don't have a problem with it. I'm with you. I think the protocol, while the intent may be good, I'm not sure if it's really always going to be executed to perfection. And so, if an NFL team has to write a check because a star quarterback wasn't hurt and he went back in the game, I really don't think they're going to care.
No, I agree. All right, is Richard Sherman going to be ready for next year? And by the way, am I the only one? I've never seen a guy be able to kind of hobble around with a torn Achilles. Is it just like mostly torn and so they got to do the surgery? It's not like completely popped and torn, and that's kind of irrelevant. I mean, he's out. He's
right.
Done. I get it. But it was kind of odd. It seemed almost like the broadcast was questioning whether or not he really had torn his Achilles tendon because he was moving around in a way that you don't usually see a guy after a completely torn tendon.
Yeah, I think what happened was is that, you know, he had an issue with it a little bit. He ruptured it. Is it completely ruptured? I don't even know the extent of it. He's going to have surgery sometime this week. Is my understanding. But he wanted to be on the sideline with his teammates. And I watched him. I was standing outside the locker room when they came off the field, and he went into the locker room in Arizona. We're waiting to do our stuff post game, and as he walks in, I mean, he was in a world of hurt. I mean, he sucked it up. He wanted to be there. You know, there's a lot of things been said and written about Richard Sherman over the years. I'm going to tell you right now, Sherman, I've never been around, and I've been with that team every game since 2011. I've never seen a team so distraught after a win. And I saw firsthand what his worth is to that team, not just as a football player, but as a leader and one of the core players. And they were devastated. And this is a guy that he is, I mean, I know he chewed out a coordinator and coaches last year, and he had a weird year last year. He was back to being the normal Richard Sherman this season. He's just a key cog for them and a heart and soul guy. And I mean, everyone was emotional after the game. He wanted to be there. It was as simple as that. And he wasn't going to be carted off the field. He wanted to be there for the final quarter and a half. And I applaud him for that, because there's a lot of things said about Richard Sherman, but great teammate isn't said enough.
All right, real quick on the M's and their free agency. What do they do? They're in a position where they can't go backwards, right? They've got to go with the Cano contract, with some of the guys they've got on this team. They've got to be all in and be looking to add to the club, don't they?
Yeah, you know, it's funny with that baseball team. You know, we have the odd time you hear people in town say, well, I think what they should do is they should just – let's go with the Houston Astros model. Let's break it all down and tear it all down and build it back up. Well, okay, that's great in theory, but you got two problems. One is, as you mentioned, Seren, you've got all those contracts. I mean, you're going to dump Cano, Cruz, Felix. You're going to dump those contracts, maybe Seager as well. And then two, I don't know, I mean, is it just me, or did Houston just do an extraordinary job of building a franchise from the ground up? And I don't think in baseball there's any guarantee you can just break it down and build it back up and be a World Series champion. That's not giving Houston enough credit. And by the way, I think the last impact player Seattle drafted is Kyle Seager. So it's not like these guys have had a great history of drafting terrific players, no matter who the GM is.
Yeah, we're dealing with the same thing here. A lot of people, like, the word comes out that Moose and Hosmer might be re-signed by the Royals. I'm like, no, we need to tank. It's amazing how we've become brainwashed. They can get rid of all your good players. That's what you
well,
do.
Houston made it really difficult for everybody else.
They did.
They really did. They went out and they got all these dudes. And, you know, they signed the second baseman off the street, and everyone laughed at them for that. They draft the left side of their infield and center field. Well, there's no guarantee that you can do that, last I checked.
Well, and they've also made it harder with the rules to just hoard all that cash. And there's not as much cash for the higher picks, so it gets a little bit harder to do it, no doubt. Ian Furness in Seattle, great stuff, buddy. We appreciate the time, man. Have a great week.
Thanks, Ren.
Where you'll find Jason Anderson, ESPN 680, Louisville, Kentucky. Jason, how are you?
Good, Seren. How are you?
I'm good. Kentucky struggling on the basketball court. Number five team in the country. We've talked about this a little bit, that they're younger than even their young teams. Usually, quietly, there's some sophomores and juniors on this team. Is this team just really young and going to be more of like an 8-9 seed, more of at least a 6-7 seed than the number one seed that people think they should be every year?
This team more closely aligns with Cal's 13 team and 14 team. That 2013 team was the one that went to the NIT. That 2014 team was one that was an 8 seed that ended up playing in the national championship game, and that's because this team has turned over their entire roster. The only guy they returned for is Wenyan Gabriel, who played a combined 26 minutes in the four NCAA tournament games last year. I mean, Cal's best teams in 2010, when they went to the Elite Eight, he returned all those guys from Billy Gillespie's team, including Patrick Patterson. In that 2012 team, he had Terrence Jones, he had Deron Lamb, he had Darius Miller. 2015, they had I'm drawing a blank now on all the players that they had on that 2012. They had the Harrison twins, they had Dakari Johnson, they had Willie Cauley-Stein. Like, they had all those different guys on that 15 team to go along with a really good recruiting class. They don't have that this year. They've got a number of really good players. And I'll tell you this too, Seren. The one thing that I think people around Kentucky might be overestimating is I don't think Kentucky has that superstar top five, top 10 lottery player on their team that Cal has typically had as well. So no experience and a number of really, really good players, but not necessarily that superstar player. I'm shocked that so many people are picking them to win the national championship. And I can't believe right now they're still the fourth favorite to win the national title at 10-1.
And that, so who is the guy that does have the chance, or guys that have the chance to maybe emerge and become? And they had such a great freshman backcourt last year. Who are the guys that maybe have a chance to step up and end up being those kind of impact guys?
I think it's Kevin Knox, and I think it's Hamidou Diallo. I mean, people remember Diallo last year because he didn't play, and then he went to the draft, and then he was late until the last minute to decide whether or not he was going to keep his name in, and he's got the 70-inch vertical leap, and everybody is enamored with how athletic he is. But we assumed that, well, he was so close to entering the draft, therefore he's going to return to Kentucky. He's going to be so good. He's going to be a superstar player, and he's going to be a lottery pick. I mean, he's a really athletic player, but as far as a basketball player, I think there's a lot to for him to develop on. Now, I think he will get there because you can clearly see a jump shot that wasn't there last year that's starting to develop. I think Diallo and Knox, the way I would describe Kevin Knox is he's a little like Malik Monk, in that Malik Monk would get anywhere he wanted to on the floor, but then he would hit the shot. Kevin Knox can get anywhere he wants to on the floor with his size and athletic ability, but I'm not sure he's going to hit the shot every time like Malik Monk did. If Knox becomes more consistent, he can be that superstar. But right now, he's been inconsistent in his ability to finish at the rim and his ability to knock down an open jumper. So they've got some guys that are there. I've described them, Seren, that I think this might be the first time in Cal's tenure that the whole might be greater than the sum of its parts for his players at the end of the year.
Louisville, number 16 in the country, trailed by three at the half against George Mason, ends up winning by 11. Plenty of turmoil, plenty of distractions going on, obviously. So with all that, is this team overrated as well?
I don't know. I think they're rated right about five. I mean, top 20 team, around 15 to 20. Their starting five is good. Quentin Snyder's a senior. Dang Adele's an NBA player. Ray Spalding could be an NBA player if he ever figured it out. Honest Mahmoud's one of the best rim protectors in the country. And VJ King's a five-star guy who's a sophomore now. And those starting five is supposed to be pretty good, but they just weren't that good against George Mason. And I think the issue for Louisville is they've got two guys that are taller than that are 6'10 and 7 foot, and Ray Spalding and Honest Mahmoud. The one guy they have off the bench in the front court is Malik Williams, who was the prize of this recruiting class. He played 1 minute in the exhibition game against Bellarmine, and he played 4 minutes against George Mason. And he's their main reserve on the front court. They played 19 of the 40 minutes against George Mason with one guy on the floor taller than 6'7". And that's an issue. They are thin in the front court, both in size and in depth. And I thought one of the things that, you know, we're going to be around here, and I hate the fact that people are going to be looking at it and going, well, what if Rick Pitino was the coach, and what would Rick Pitino have done? I want to give David Padgett an opportunity just to be the coach, because I thought there was one particular play yesterday, Seren, that showed me that Padgett wasn't necessarily coaching for the I want to be like Rick, or as you say, coaching for the press conference. Right. They were up by three, and out of a timeout, he had Darius Perry, who's his attacking freshman guard, and Jordan Nwora, who's there just to shoot the three. He had both of them on the floor. He called a play for Darius Perry to drive an attack. Nwora replaced the penetrator. Perry kicks it back out. Nwora takes the shot, buries the three. They go up by six and control the game. And I'm thinking to myself, if Perry turns it over or Nwora misses the shot, David Padgett's going to be answering questions about the fact that Rick Pitino would never trust freshmen in that spot. And instead, he said, Perry's my penetrator. Nwora's my shooter. This is the play I want to do it. This is how we're going to win. Let's go out and execute it. And they executed it, and they end up winning the game.
All right, let's talk about Lamar Jackson, the quarterback, defending Heisman Trophy winner. He's got two games and a bowl game still to go. He's on pace to throw for more yards, maybe get to the same touchdown total, maybe have less interceptions. The passer rating is pretty much the exact same. He's got 1,176 yards. By the way, the 3,000 passing and 1,100 rushing makes him the first quarterback in the history of college football to have back-to-back 3,000 passing, 1,000-yard rushing seasons. But he could end up topping the rushing total. He's averaging 6.6 yards per carry. Last year it was six. Touchdown-wise, he could top that note. But he's not going to win the Heisman, right? Is that a shame? Does he deserve it?
I mean, it sort of depends. If you're looking at individual stats, I mean, does he deserve it? Yeah, he's put up the craziest numbers all season long. I mean, we've been tracking this all season, Seren, that he could end up with more passing yards than Baker Mayfield and more rushing yards than Saquon Barkley. But at this point, he's not even one of the top four guys to win the Heisman. I think it would be a travesty if he doesn't even make it to New York, because he still continues to be, at least in my estimation, the best college football player that's out there. I mean, the problem is his defense has been so bad. They got rid of Todd Grantham. He went down to Mississippi State. They brought in this new guy, Peter Sermon, and he's been terrible. And Louisville's losing all these games. And because they're losing games, Lamar Jackson is sort of put on the back burner. And we always love the new guy. We love the next great player. And so we've seen Lamar Jackson. We know how great he is. He won the Heisman last year. Let's move on to the next guy. But he's putting up stupid numbers, and he's going to continue putting up those numbers. I would say, though, Seren, I don't know that he has two games left in the bowl game. I know that he's got two games left, but if they play in just some random bowl game as a 7-5 team, and Lamar Jackson thinking about going pro and being a first-round draft pick, I think we get into the same conversation we've got into with a number of these players that we will continue to get into. And why would Lamar Jackson go out there and risk himself if he's going to go pro? And also, Louisville opens with Alabama next year. Why wouldn't they go ahead and play in the bowl game, the guy Juwan Pass, who's the backup to Lamar, who's going to be the next quarterback at Louisville, if you want to get ready to play Alabama a year from now or at the beginning of that next season?
No, it's all valid. It would suck, but it's all absolutely valid and probably exactly what's going to happen. And listen, it'll all be rendered moot when this salty Syracuse defense gets their shot at it. They don't give up 64 to just anybody. You got to be a big time program like Wake Forest to hang 64 on my orange. Real quick on Kentucky football, getting 21.5 from Georgia. Had they not lost to Ole Miss, I think that spread would have been half that. 2 weeks ago, that was a bad loss for the Wildcats. What happens in this game? Do they have any shot of pulling the upset in this game?
The only shot I think they have is if Georgia has sort of a hangover of losing to Auburn and then being ranked wherever they're going to be ranked tonight or tomorrow night in between those two games in the Champions Classic, whenever the playoff rankings come out. If they get dropped and they feel like they lost an opportunity to go and guarantee themselves a spot in the college football playoff and maybe even lose to Alabama in the SLA, that's the only thing. If there's sort of some malaise, but Kentucky isn't good enough. I mean, Georgia outclasses and outmans Kentucky. The only way Kentucky can win games is if they can establish the run. And against Mississippi State, they didn't, and they got pummeled. And I don't think they're going to be able to do that against Georgia either. So I don't think Kentucky has much of a chance to knock off Georgia. I don't know about the line. I would probably say if Georgia's got a hangover, maybe Kentucky can keep it close or maybe even backdoor cover. But I don't think they're going to win this game. I don't think they have a chance of winning this game.
Jason Anderson in Louisville. Great stuff as always, buddy. We appreciate it. Have a great week.
You do the same.